Phil Riley's here. We got you guys, church. We can welcome Phil Riley. He's from IJM. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate having you.
Thanks so much, Luke. Yes, I have an accent. Don't adjust your sets. Hopefully, you will be able to understand me. It's a privilege again to be back with you here this morning. And we're going to be looking at the book of Esther. Not the entire book, but segments of it. And looking at Esther's life as a call to action and as a character in the Bible that can inspire us to be engaged with some of the injustice that we see around the world. So it's a privilege to open up Scripture with you this morning. And for those of you who are perhaps unfamiliar with International Justice Mission, or you are a guest here at Saanich, welcome. I'll just give you a very brief overview on International Justice Mission, who I represent, and what we do in the world. IJM has been in existence since 1997, tackling complex casework such as property grabbing, sexual violence, and our new casework of online sexual exploitation of minors, human trafficking, police abuse of power, forced labor, and bonded slavery. We have 16 field offices around the world, and we have over 600 staff. 95% of our staff on the field are nationals. So in Uganda, it's Ugandan lawyers, Ugandan church pastors, Ugandan investigators who are taking ownership of the complex work of property grabbing and changing the country. And that's quite remarkable. Our model, as we work alongside police and government officials, is to rescue victims, bring criminals to justice, restore survivors to places of safety and strength, and strengthen justice systems. My hope for you and I today is not for you to leave feeling burdened, at least not in a bad way or overwhelmed with what you hear, but rather, I want us to all be equipped, challenged, and motivated to move forward to what the writer Frederick Buechner says this: the place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. That is my hope for you this morning, that you would be inspired, that you would leave here having been transformed and meeting God. So, the story of Esther, let's just dive right in here. If I were to highlight one thing that I always knew about the book of Esther, it would be that it's a book that's difficult to find. So, if you want to find the book of Esther, you can open up your Bible and it will fall in the middle to the book of Psalms. Just go two books back and you will find Esther. If you have any problems with that, Rick is at the front and he will direct you to the book of Esther. Right, Rick? You can find it in a heartbeat. There we go. It's on his iPhone. The other thing about the book, which is very interesting, is that God, his name, is not mentioned at all in the entire book. And I'm going to return to that later. You can go ahead and read this book. If you don't understand my accent right now, you can read it in its entirety. And you will not find God's name mentioned once. So hold that thought. Who was Esther? And why is this story in particular important for you and I today? So I'm going to give you I'm going to open the book up to us. Bear with me. There is a point to all of this. I'm going to go through the setting, the plot, the main characters, just to give you an overview of what Esther's action was and her courageous call to was. The story of Esther takes place in the city called Susa, which is now in modern-day Iran. Esther is a diaspora story. That is, Esther is about a people who were dispersed. In 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Solomon's temple. He tore down the walls of Jerusalem and sent all of the Jewish population out in exile for many years. That was, they were dispersed. And this was an incredibly painful time for the Jewish people. They were trying to figure out what it meant to be Jewish in exile. They were also trying to work out how to retain their identity in the context of the Persian Empire, as well as what it meant to stay true to this identity in the midst of the pressure to conform to the culture's unbelieving kings. One commentator says that individual books like Daniel, like Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther all deal with how individual Jews navigated those tricky waters, keeping identity of in exile. And so today we're looking at one particular story in that genre, Esther's story. So who were some of the main characters? There are some great names here, so you can take notes here. So there were Xerxes. What a great name that is. An incredibly powerful king. He was an elaborate king. In fact, he was a party king. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for his nobles and all of his officials. Then he had 180 days of displaying the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. And in the midst of that, he had feasts and where guests could drink as much wine as they wanted. There was also a character named Vashti. And Vashti was a queen at the time who disobeyed King Xerxes and paved the way for Esther. Now, there's a passage in Esther, chapter 1, verses 10 to 12, where Vashti disobeys the king. She's summoned to the court because of her beauty, and Xerxes wanted to display her to all of the nobles and officials at the time, and she says no. Now, the passage doesn't reveal about why Vashti did this, but it's hard not to wonder whether she was resisting being treated as an object brought out for the viewing pleasure of men. Whatever the reasons were why she refused and disobeyed the king, it paved the way for a new queen, Esther. There are two other characters in the story who are important. Esther, of course, and Mordecai. But who were they? Along with many of the Jewish people, a man named Mordecai had been taken captive and exiled from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. He brought with him his orphaned cousin, Esther, and because he raised her since her parents died. So though we know Esther as a queen in the book, she began life as a powerless member of a powerless group. She was just a Joe Blog, as it were, an exiled member of the Jewish people. When the time came for Xerxes to look for a new king, because of Esther's beauty, she was taken to the king's palace and became part of his harem. During that time, she didn't reveal her nationality or family background, and eventually she was made queen instead of Vashti. So having come from very humble beginnings, from a powerless group, she now found herself in a very different setting. Now we encounter the plot. This is where it gets exciting. At this point, Esther has just been appointed queen, and a plot unfolds. Something important happens in Mordecai's life that proves very significant in this story later on. And that is, he's at the king's gate one day, and as he's sitting at the king's gate, he overhears a conversation. A conversation about a conspiracy to kill Xerxes. So he shared this with Esther. Esther reported that conspiracy to the king, crediting Mordecai. The plot was foiled and Xerxes was spared. However, another drama was about to unfold. Following the failed assassination plans, King Xerxes honored a man called Haman, giving him a seat of honor in the palace above all other nobles and officials. People bow down to him, except for one group. Who might that group be? The Jews. Mordecai and Esther, they did not bow down to Haman. Haman was disturbed because of this, and his pride was damaged. And he says to Xerxes these words, "There is a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all of the provinces of your kingdom, O king, who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all the other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let there be a decree to destroy them." The Jewish people, all through this time, had managed to stay true to their identity, to their God, their customs, even in exile. But now their values were clashing with this Persian king's values. Xerxes' response to Haman, "Do what you please. Do as you please with them." So he set up an order to destroy all of the Jewish people. And then at the end of that plot scene, they sat down, Xerxes and Haman, and drank wine. Esther's call to action now. So here we have a scene of the most unbelievable tragedies. Not only are the Jewish people in exile, but one man, because of his own pride, was determined that they are utterly wiped out. And this is where Esther comes in. Esther sent one of the king's eunuchs to ask Mordecai, "Why are you in sackcloth and ashes? Why is it that you are grieving?" And we read these words, "Mordecai gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people." And Esther at this moment was about to be called into action. But there was one snag. In Esther 4, we read these words. Hathach, who was this person who was sending notes back between Mordecai and Esther, Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, and listen to these words very carefully, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king, he has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends his gold scepter and spares their life." And so here we see a very human response by Esther at this moment. She thinks, "I can't possibly do anything. I can't just enter the king's court and plead for my people. It's too big an issue. It's too big a problem for me to deal with." Mordecai sends back a message to her. And this is the key passage in the book of Esther that this whole message rests on. He says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all of the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, "Go gather together all of the Jews and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. If I perish, I perish." It's interesting that in the midst of Mordecai's despair and grief, he still believes that God will deliver his people. In fact, God will do something miraculous through this queen, Esther, a powerless person from a powerless group who is now brought into this time for such a time as this to take on this task. The plot then thickens, and Esther approaches Xerxes, and he does in fact extend the scepter, allowing her to bring her requests to the king. And I think most of us would expect Esther to ask directly for her people to be spared. But instead, she invites Xerxes and Haman to a banquet. And at that banquet, she invites them to another banquet. Haman brags about this, but in spite of this honor, he is tormented by the fact that Mordecai still doesn't bow down, nor does Esther bow down to him. So he sets up a pole in this banquet arena to impale Mordecai at the end of the banquet. The night before the second banquet, Xerxes can't sleep and starts having the books of his reign read to him. Kind of like a nighttime story like we read to our children. And he discovers that it was Mordecai who foiled the assassination attempt. And he asks, what should be done for this, for the man for the king delights to honor? Haman assumes the king is referring to him, and so he suggests that this man is paraded around the city, given glory and honor, and a royal robe, only to discover that it's Mordecai who's going to get this honor. And you can't help but wonder how Haman was feeling at that point. Anyway, the banquet takes place, and Esther steps in to courageous action. At that banquet, she shares her true identity with the king. And then, speaking on behalf of her people, she says these words, "If I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated." The king asks, who would dare to do such a thing? And the truth is revealed. It was Haman. He, instead, was impaled on the pole that he had set up for Mordecai. So the truth was out. And the result? Esther wasn't only spared, but she was given Haman's estate. Mordecai was brought into the king's presence and given his a signet ring. Wouldn't it be amazing today to be part of seeing people's sorrow turn to joy and their mourning turn to celebration because we too stepped into action for such a time as this? You see, because of Esther's willingness to step out in faith and put her life on the line for her people, celebration and joy resulted from near annihilation. The Jewish people, so close to losing their lives, could now rejoice and celebrate. This remains a timeless call in our time. What does it mean for you and I to take on board what Esther had done? So courageous, stepping out in faith. How can Esther's story inspire and compel us to speak and act on behalf of our brothers and sisters, both around the world and right here in our local spheres? As we look to apply this story, I want to look at three areas very briefly. Why the call to act is as relevant and urgent today as it was for Esther. Why courage is key. And thirdly, the presence, protection, and the purposes of God in Esther's story, in our story, and in the world's story. The particular horror and injustice that we read about in Esther, and that God mercifully prevented, essentially equates to what we would refer to now as ethnic cleansing or genocide. It would be amazing if we could read about that just in a pure historical context without it resonating in our present day. But I only have to mention three countries to you to make you understand that this is still prevalent today. Rwanda. Just over 20 years ago, 800,000 people were brutally murdered in the space of 40 days. Burundi, currently what is going on there right now as I speak here. And then, of course, Cambodia, which we're going to hear about in a few minutes. The world is not as it should be. It is not the way God intended it to be. We see so much beauty and goodness in the world, so many things that remind us of God's active presence in creating and restoring. But in the midst of this, we have to face a broken world. There are 36 million people in slavery. 4 billion of the world's poor live outside of the protection of the law. 2 million children are currently exploited in the commercial sex trade around the world. But what does it look like when you and I take a stand and stand in the gap for those on the margins? What happens when people like you take a courageous call for such a time as this? I want to take you to Cambodia. When we first started our work in Cambodia, it was viewed by many as ground zero for the commercial exploitation of minors, especially those under 15 years old. In the early 2000s, when we first started our work there, the Cambodian government had estimated that the prevalence of minors being exploited in Phnom Penh was as high as 15 to 30%. The abuse was as disturbing as it was widespread. A 2003 investigation by NBC's Dateline, in partnership with IGM, found children as young as 6 being openly marketed for those who would travel for exploitation in the capital city, Phnom Penh. This brazen trafficking and abuse flourished in large part because of a broken public system. In this broken system, victims of trafficking were often treated as criminals themselves. Thankfully, though, the heartbreaking picture of very young girls being sold openly is no longer an accurate picture or reflection of what is going on in Cambodia today. There are still improvements to be made, but 15 years of collaboration between Cambodian leaders, police, government officials, courts, social services, and other NGOs that we partner with, the community has made a dramatic change for Cambodia's children. A 2015 prevalence study conducted by IGM found the prevalence of minors in the three largest commercial sex markets in the country, Phnom Penh, Siem Reap, and Siankville, has dropped to 2.2%, with minors 15 years and younger making up just 0.1%. We celebrate this change. Cambodia has been transformed because of the courage of people like Sek Sorin, who we're going to meet right now.
My childhood was an awful situation. When I was born in 1975, many intellectuals and educated people were killed by the Khmer Rouge. And after that, Cambodia needed a good background of people who had high education to teach the younger generation. So I had to do something if I had a chance. My name is Sek Sorin. I'm a lawyer and director of legal department of International Justice Mission in Cambodia.
We're about to reach Martini. You can see the Martini pub, you see? Yeah.
And one night, there were two IGM team approach a DJ counter where I was working. It was dangerous. Sometimes there were fighting, shooting inside the club. It was one of the places where the customer could find girls, especially young girls to have sex. They asked them, how many customers per day? How many girls per day? What are their age ranges? Initially, I was nervous. I had a chance to join IGM team to conduct the first operation. I was assigned to be an informant. In 2003, I started law school. When we start to fight, I thought it was impossible because of the broken public justice system. And for me, as I'm a victim's lawyer, sometimes I felt discouraged because my client was jailed. I thought, oh, it's not possible to win the case. But remember, any problem can be solved. We have seen dramatic decrease of commercial and sexual exploitation of minors. I'm really passionate in advocating this model that IJAM created really, really good. First, we rescue the victim of violence. Second, we bring the criminals to justice. Third, restore the survivors. And fourth, we strengthen the justice system. We've been working with passionate people. The performance of police and the court are more proactive, increase more collaboration right now. That's why we become a leading country to fight this problem. I feel very honored, I feel very privileged and to be a part of this change. It's been 10 years I have been involved in this fight, protecting children. And we do it now and we continue to do it in the future. Who can be a part of this fight for the children? My childhood was an awful situation when I was born in 1975. Many intellectuals and educated.
God's name is not mentioned once, and yet God's presence is tangible in the deliverance and redemption of a terrible situation. One commentator remarks, Esther is about God's hidden presence in exile. It's a book that demonstrates that God is present and working, even though it appears that God has abandoned his people in Babylon. God is present in this story, protecting, guiding, and redeeming, even when he seems absent. And God is always present in our own stories, even at the times where he feels absent. In fact, I believe that God is present and right in the center of the world's pain, the very place where we often question him. I also want to remind us that God is present in our very desire to engage with the world around us. The passions we have for justice and redemption are God-given. The compassion we feel for children, whether it's in Cambodia, for our neighbors, for our friends, for our city, for our country, is God-given. This is why it is important for you and I to continually walk with God, seeking him and surrounding all that we do in prayer. I believe, too, that we are not here at Saanich Baptist on May 29th for a random reason. You were not a random mistake. You live your life, you do what you do, you are who you are for a purpose. And I believe that you too, like Esther and my friend Sek Soren, are here for such a time as this.